Demographers project that by the middle of the century, one in four people on the planet will be a Muslim, an important reason for the West and the Islamic world to work out ways to get along. Akbar Ahmed, a leading Islamic scholar and professor at American University in Washington, D.C., set out last year on a field trip with a small group of his students to try to find out what Muslims all over the world are really thinking. The results of their trip are reported in Journey into Islam, The Crisis of Globalization. It's published by Brookings Institution Press, and I'm delighted it has brought Professor Ahmed to my show today. Hello.
Thank you, Leonard. Thank you for asking me. Pleasure to be here, and especially in this great and vibrant city. I'm coming from Washington, where the atmosphere does tend to become a little bit of a hothouse.
Well, there is that that sense that everything that is important takes place within the Beltway. Some other people might disagree. Who decided to undertake this journey? Was it you or was it your students' suggestion?
No, Leonard, the idea germinated, in fact, on 9/11. I had just joined American University, just started my class, second or third class, when the plane slammed into the Pentagon just a few miles from American University in Washington. And, of course, you had your tragic events taking place on the same day. And I very quickly got involved in a debate, a discussion, an exercise in interfaith, bridge building all across the United States. And I began to hear opinions about Islam, what the world was saying about Islam. And similarly, I was hearing what the Muslim world was saying about the West. And I became very uneasy, very uncomfortable. As time proceeded, I felt that I, as an anthropologist, had to get back myself. And I taught classes on campus, and some of my students were very excited about the idea, and they said, can we come along? And this was a new dimension and a bit risky because, remember, these Americans traveling in the Muslim world. I mean, for me, too, as an American university professor, it was bad enough, but to actually have actual Americans. And yet we managed to pull it off and come back with some really incredible information and data and statistics.
Americans at the time were shocked by some of the reactions they saw from around the world, from the Islamic world. And I'm assuming that people in that world were shocked by some of the things they were hearing from the United States and the West.
There is a great deal of misunderstanding on both sides, Leonard. I must constantly point this out because, remember, we were acting as bridge builders, as friends of both the cultures, all of us, me and my team. These wonderful young Americans, they had never been to the Muslim world. One of them was a Muslim American, the rest were not. So for them, it was a new experience. We found, for example, in the Muslim world, very high levels of anti-Semitism. And I was asked to speak at mosques and madrasas on university campuses. We met presidents, princes, and so on. And this really was something I had to tackle because the high levels of anti-Americanism and anti-Semitism had become a kind of challenge for me.
No matter where you went, because we understand that might be likely in the Middle East. But you went to Asia, Africa.
Yes. We went right up to the Indonesian island so that we did find this. It's very interesting because we found as we left the Middle East, the intensity changed. So that while people often said that we are anti-Semitic and so on in a very crude and I think superficial way, at the same time, there was also a deep awareness of the bonds with Judaism as part of the Abrahamic faiths, because there is a very strong foundation of overlap, of common identities, history between the Judaic faith and Islam.
Well, the Quran has conflicting things about Jews. On the one hand, it says that Islam grows out of the Judeo-Christian tradition. On the other hand, there are any number of times when Muhammad is very angry with Jews, and they're are killings of Jews, so it's a complicated story. And since the Quran is literal truth, that I'm sure leads to some of that anti-Semitism.
It does, Leonard. Like all texts, like all holy texts, whether it's the Judaic or the Christian or indeed non-Abrahamic, I think the word of God or the mind of God is difficult to gauge, certainly for a mortal like me. At the same time, I take principles from a faith. And for me, the fact that every Muslim five times a day must pray to Abraham and bless Abraham and the descendants of Abraham, and the faith of Islam is constantly referring to Abraham and Moses and all the great biblical figures, really underlines the bonds more than the cultural clashes or the political clashes of that time.
Well, how much of it comes out of Islam and how much of it comes out of the politics of these different countries? The former president of Malaysia used to blame everything that went wrong on some Jewish conspiracy when there was a crash of the Malaysian stock market. He said the Jews were behind it. I'd imagine that he's reflecting some opinions of his people, but he's also giving some direction to the people of his country.
Yes, he's feeding into what I've pointed out, that there is a great sense of anti-Semitism in the Muslim world, and that feeds in. And again, see what the average Muslim is actually picking up in terms of their understanding of the Jewish world. They're seeing the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which was a fiction created by the Tsar's Secret Service Police in the late 19th century. They're seeing that as documentaries being broadcast in Arabic, and they really believe that. So I had to challenge them on this documentary too.
My guest is Akbar Ahmed. His book, Journey into Islam, The Crisis of Globalization, is published by Brookings Institution Press. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You visited one of the most orthodox Islamic madrasas in South Asia, Deoband. What are the students being taught there?
They are, again, Leonard, being taught a very orthodox, literalist kind of Islam, and that for me became one of the models. I identified three distinct models of Muslim behavior.
And this was the most radical?
This was
the
most, yes.
Fundamental.
The third model. The first, of course, is the Sufi mystic model. The second is the modernist model, where the Muslim lives with integrity within his tradition but reaches out to other cultures and systems. And the third is this literalist orthodox model, where Muslims believe Islam is under attack and therefore Islam must be protected at all costs. This is where a literal interpretation becomes very dangerous to some. I want to underline this because not everyone believes in violence. But this is where you get the sources of what we are seeing today as the jihadists or the fundamentalists and so on. So we actually decided to visit this center. It was my first visit.
And they have a very strong anti-American sense. And yet you would bring a whole bunch of American students there. How were you treated?
We were treated interestingly because I was a bit tense. I didn't tell my students that this was going to be the great test case for our visit. I had to go there because without going to what is really the core of the third model, it would be pointless coming back and just writing something on Islam. It would be one dimension would be missing. And of course, I was invited as an honored Muslim scholar. I was treated very warmly, a bit distant at first, a bit coldly at first. But as the day wore on, the warmth became quite palpable. And even my students, my American students, were then received with warmth because I had said, I'm bringing these kids and they are like my family. This girl's like my daughter, the boy's like my son. So by the end of the evening, we were invited to the homes of the chief cleric. The girl met the female members of the family of the cleric. And in the end, these students were in a class full of bearded young men and writing warm messages of friendship for America across this chasm between the two civilizations on the blackboard.
What kinds of questions were asked on both sides?
Well, very interesting. Of course, the first question is always, did you support Bush in the elections? So my American students had to be very defensive and they'd say, who is your role model? So the answer would be from these bearded young men. Just, I really think they were just being emotional and on the defensive. Osama bin Laden, immediately. So it my students were mature enough to understand what was going on, and they would try to calm things down and try to really make them talk and open, because we wanted to listen. Right across this journey of ours, we wanted to listen and then record, and that's what we've done in the book.
But when you asked who your role model was to people all across the spectrum, including the modernists, often the answer was Osama bin Laden or Ahmadinejad or Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah.
You're right. In fact, I became a bit despondent at one stage, and my students who know me very well, because I teach, had taught them in the honors program, they know my hero was Mr. Jinnah, the founder of Pakistan, who believed in a modern Muslim state when he founded Pakistan in the late 1940s.
He was a secularist in the same way that Gandhi was.
Yeah, exactly. He was of the same, in fact, he was the same age as Gandhi, and they had a very interesting love-hate kind of relationship, but they had great mutual respect for each other. So he believed in the constitution, women's rights, minority rights, a man of great international standing as a statesman. Now, that was my hero, and when I found that increasingly, even in Pakistan, and this is what alarmed me, even in Pakistan, some young scholars, students were actually saying Osama bin Laden, not very loudly, but they were saying this. I was alarmed because when I was growing up in the 1960s, Jinnah was the towering figure for all of us.
But we're seeing more and more Orthodox literalists in Pakistan. The fight over the Red Mosque, for example, is a perfect example of that. Do you see this sort of thing happening throughout the more secular countries? Turkey, for example, right now, the big debate is over whether a devout Muslim should be allowed to be president of the country, and it's likely he will be.
I would, Leonard, answer your question by saying that you need to look at the Muslim world through the three models. If you look at it through the three models, rather than as a monolith, which is what it is seen as from here in America, normally people see the Muslim world as one solid mass, which it is not. There are three very distinct models with history, with identity, with a way of looking at the world. If you see it like that, then the formula is simple. The more the pressure on Islam in a crude or aggressive way, the greater the strength for this third model. Because the first model, the mystics and Sufis, Rumi, for example, the great quintessential model of the first kind, he says, I go to the synagogue, I go to the church, I go to the mosque, and I see the same spirit and the same altar. Now, he's not going to say blow yourselves up or indulge in suicide attacks. The second model, the modernist, is going to say stick to the constitution, stick to the law. Again, he becomes irrelevant to these people today. The third model is going to say an eye for an eye, revenge for revenge. So you're seeing right across the Muslim world this model now ascendant.
But isn't it complicated by the fact that Saddam Hussein would have been called a modernist, wouldn't he?
Exactly. You're right. You're right. In fact, I put my finger on it on this journey because I, of course, assumed that Jinnah is the modernist par excellence. But I said, wait a minute.
That's based on your background.
But on my background from South Asia. And you know, there is a very strong tradition of democracy, although it's constantly being derailed by bouts of martial law. We've had female prime ministers both in Pakistan and in Bangladesh and so on. Now, there were modernist leaders like Saddam Hussein, like Assad in Syria, who were saying, no, we don't look to the West with this tradition of parliamentary democracy, like Jinnah, for example, but we look to the Soviets. We want a socialist system, one-man rule, a dictatorship. Stalin is our model. And that really did not catch in the Muslim world. It was there, but it remained marginal. So you're absolutely right that some of these dictators would justify their rule then. And if you recall, in the 1990s, Saddam very quickly discovered Islam. So suddenly he used to cast himself as an Islamic warrior.
Because the secular approach was causing him trouble.
And it had failed. I mean, he really was just a dictator. He would have been as ruthless and as murderous in any garb.
When you went to these different places, were the responses different? For example, in the more westernized countries like Turkey or Indonesia, as opposed to some of the ones that we would associate with Orthodox literalism, Saudi Arabia, for example?
I would say, Leonard, that again, as an anthropologist, I was looking for what anthropologists call, quote-unquote, deep structures, looking beneath the surface. And beneath the surface, really, the three models do work quite well with all kinds of qualifications and clauses. They do work quite well. So that even in Turkey, you'll be amazed at the depth of the mystic Sufi feeling and emotions, even today. You know, Rumi is in fact buried in Turkey, in Konya. So there is that sense that Rumi gives us peace. He gives us enlightenment. He gives us a capacity to reach out to the whole universe and not be restricted by our race, by our religion, by our culture.
Well, but the Sufis have very little real impact in the Islamic world.
And less impact.
And they withdraw, in fact.
But this is the problem, because the more you have the ascendancy of the third model, the more marginalized the mystics become, and even the modernists.
Another modernist is Pervez Musharraf. And I don't think of him as being part of any kind of an enlightened way of dealing with either politics or with religion, for that matter, because he plays it both ends against the middle too, doesn't he?
There you are. You yourself have put your finger on it. Musharraf he came with tremendous potential because he grew up in the tradition of following someone like Jinnah. And now, he had the chance in 1999 when he took over, and by and large, Pakistanis were happy because they said, we've had these very corrupt governments. Musharraf is going to bring us back onto the right track. He's talking about Jinnah and moderation and so on. But 7-8 years later, you see the shambles this whole system has become. You've got law and order problems, serious problems. You've got a resurgence of almost this extravagant, anarchic kind of Islam. You have a constitutional crisis. I would not say that he's very close to the pure modernist model of Jinnah, who really believed in undiluted democracy.
You argue that as a response to 9/11, the current administration created a situation where Americans came to associate Islam with terrorism and the enemy. Given the fact that extremist views evidently resonate widely amongst Muslims of all backgrounds, don't those people who compare Islamic fundamentalism to, say, the rise of fascism in Germany in the 1930s have something of a point?
They have a point, but not a very strong point. Let me give you a concrete example, which is in my book. The 1990s, the London School of Economics, two students who never met. One goes on to be implicated in the murder of Danny Pearl, the son of my friend Judea Pearl. As you know, Judea and I are doing these Jewish-Muslim dialogues all over the place. And the other one, my own daughter, who goes on to become the first ever director of the first ever Jewish-Muslim center at Cambridge. Now, how would you explain the second category of Muslim behavior when you talk in terms of fascism and Nazism and so on? It doesn't make sense at all to me, because there is a very strong counter strand within Islam itself, and we need to recognize this, and I would say need to encourage it, nurture it, and bring it out. Because if we don't, then there is every danger of the third category becoming the dominant one.
We have to take a little break. When we come back, I want to ask you about England. The New York Times reported yesterday on the introduction of civics classes for Muslims in Britain that are part of the Labour government's goal to win back the hearts and minds of youths at risk of becoming radicalized. My guest is Akbar Ahmed. His book, Journey into Islam, The Crisis of Globalization, is published by Brookings Institution Press. Stay with us. We're back with my guest, Akbar Ahmed, who is a professor of at American University in Washington, D.C., and as we've been discussing, he set out with a group of students to visit various parts of the Islamic world to find out what people are really thinking. And the result is a book called Journey into Islam, The Crisis of Globalization. Before we went into that break, I mentioned the New York Times report yesterday about the Labour government's introduction of civics classes for Muslims in Britain. Now, it seems shocking to me that Britain would even have to do that with its own Muslim community, but in the light of the bombing in London and also the doctor's plot, I guess it has no choice.
It has no choice, and I was there, in fact, in England when all this happened. I was at the center at Cambridge, the Jewish Muslim Center. I was asked to give a keynote that for that conference. The center, for example, has done some very useful work. They are creating right now, producing syllabi for Jewish and Islamic traditions, which will now become part of the teaching in England, which I think are really important steps being taken in the UK, and I think these are things that we could be thinking about. Here, too, we've got some major initiatives happening in terms of interfaith, because I would really, Leonard, emphasize this. Considering the situation in the Muslim world, it is one, I would say, as a Muslim scholar, it is one of great concern to me, just watching what's happening there. And unless we begin to understand what's happening there and then vigorously pursue bridge building, winning hearts and minds, and bringing down the temperature of anti-Americanism and anti-Semitism, we are in for a long and troubled century ahead. And I would say the exercises that are happening in Cambridge, or my friends, for example, at in Washington, like Bishop John Chain and Senior Rabbi Bruce Lustig of the Washington Hebrew Congregation, they launched this first Abraham Summit not long after 9/11, or the initiative of Judea Pearl asking me to join him on this tour, the travels of the dialogues that we are having. This is calculated to create appreciation, understanding, and really talking about hard issues so that people have some better understanding and are not prepared to resort to violence or abuse or throwing things at each other.
I would say that until fairly recently, the loudest voices in the Muslim world were from the modernists, and now they are from the group that we associate with jihad. Why do you think that's changed? Did the modernists fail in their mission?
Yes, again, you put your finger on it. The modernists really did fail. When I was growing up, there was no doubt in anyone's mind that the future belonged to the modernists, 60s, 70s. In the 70s, things begin to change. You remember there's the Iranian Revolution, the Soviets invade Afghanistan, this resistance to Afghanistan comes through Islamic idiom, of course, backed by the United States. And very soon, by the 1990s, you're seeing the map of the Muslim world changing and the mood changing, and the young now finding other role models. And therefore, that becomes a challenge because the modernist vision is partly on the ropes now, partly failed, and really needs to be revived if there's any hope of genuine democracy, genuine human rights, civil liberties issues being taken up in the Muslim world.
When you returned to your former school in Aligarh in northern India, what had changed?
Well, my former school, of course, was Karachi Grammar School in Karachi and Foreman Christian College, where President Musharraf studied in Lahore. What has changed is that a lot of the youngsters are no longer as sure as we were when we were growing up in these schools of the future and the direction of the future and the role models that inspired these kids. These kids really are, even in, you mentioned Aligarh, which was the quintessential modernist college and then later University of South Asia. The Muslims growing up here are uncertain. They are sort of suspended between different cultures, the Western culture and their own culture. And I think they can be pushed into any direction. So if they genuinely feel Islam is under attack and they're being humiliated and their honor has been taken and they need to retaliate, they're going to go for this third model. And the third model, of course, can easily then tilt over, go over the brink, and you'll have an unending queue for suicide bombers, as you're seeing now, even in Pakistan, where there is no tradition of suicide bombing.
How much of this is fueled by a sense of humiliation in the past? I've spoken to some people who've actually brought up the Crusades as a reason for anger among Muslims. I mean, the Crusades were a long time ago. When you speak to people in Iran, they remind us that the CIA overthrew Mossadegh. That was in the 50s. Many people will remind you that Israel was created against the best wishes of Muslims. Whether it should have or not is another discussion. But then all of those countries in the Middle East were created by the colonial powers, mostly the British. We wouldn't have Iraq if the British hadn't drawn certain lines in the sand, and Syria and Jordan. All of these past humiliations, they seemed for a long time to be recognized as part of the real world. Now they all seem to be seen as the West trying to change Islam and trying to modernize it, and that's a cause for fighting the West.
Yes, it's complicated because each society has these symbols of victory, symbols of defeat, which are turned into a burning sense of nationalism. Each civilization, you had in the Balkans, you had the Serbs looking at a defeat by the Turks centuries ago, and that became a symbol of Serb nationalism. You're right to point out that the Crusades are still, especially in the Middle East, the Crusades aren't still remembered in other parts of the Muslim world, for example, in South Asia or Indonesia. But for the Arabs, they remain very much. For the South Asians, there may be other incidents, like you point to in Iran, you point to Mossadegh's overthrow and so on. So there is that.
Because and the Shah's coziness.
And then the Shah's, yes, with the West. And, of course, Musharraf is now facing the backlash for precisely the same thing. These memories remain in most societies. It isn't simply a question of East or West. What is happening in the Muslim world, there is a great sense of honor and dignity being lost. And I think, therefore, the sense of high temperature, the high anti-American, high anti-Semitism, I am optimistic that it can come down fairly quickly. And then you're left with a hardcore of people who are, say, anti-Western or anti-Semitic, and they can be dealt with differently. Otherwise, what I'm seeing is the temperature fairly high, the constant Islamophobic attacks coming from the West feeding into it, and this temperature not being affected is remaining at boiling point, I would even say at bursting point.
The Islamophobic things, like the television show 24?
Not so much that, because people realize that's a television show. For example, attacks on Islam itself, on the God or the Prophet of Islam, prominent figures calling Islam a religion of Satan worshippers and devil worshippers. Now, this just baffles people. I think the categories in the first and second type of Muslim would just be amused and dismiss this kind of absurd comment on Islam. But the people in the third category may, in fact, be angry. Some of them may be even violent about it. They may even do something stupid and anarchic. So we need to be aware of the interconnectedness of the world we're living in. We're living in the age of globalization. Everything that's happening over there makes an immediate impact over here, and what things are said here, discussed here, are being heard over there. And we really need to listen to each other a bit more, have a bit more patience with each other, and really begin to say, look, can we live as world communities? Because if not, you have pointed out, Leonard, it is going to be one out of four people by the middle of this century. We already have 57 nations that are Muslim, one nuclear for the time being. You may have another half a dozen very soon. And where are we going to go with all this?
I know Samuel Huntington is not the most admired figure in Islam, but aren't we heading for a clash of civilizations, as he put it?
We almost are in a clash of civilizations, unless, and here's the good news, unless the opposite idea, the dialogue of civilizations, succeeds. And for that, I may call up my friends like the chief rabbi of the United Kingdom, Sir Jonathan Sacks, who's written a marvelous book called The Dignity of Difference, some of the most prominent figures in the West, like the Archbishop of Canterbury, some of the people I mentioned, Bishop John Chain in Washington, Rabbi Lustig in Washington, and so on. There are people who believe that there is a world crisis. It can be averted if we are prepared to reach out, understand, and certainly identify what is going on in a scholarly, objective, yet sympathetic way.
Now, the subtitle of this book, as we have said a number of times, is The Crisis of Globalization. How does globalization fit into this crisis?
Directly. A figure I give from Sir Jonathan Sacks's book, The Dignity of Difference, in the book I quote it, there are 358 individuals who own financial wealth equal to half the world's population. Now, that's fine, as long as half the world's population is not living in quite the dire conditions that they are living in right now. So when you travel in the Muslim world and you come across the poverty and the squalor, and you talk to Muslims and they say, what is our life? Where do we go with this kind of life? We have nothing available to us. Their anger then is directed to their own government. But what they very often see behind their government is a Western power propping them up. And that's true throughout the Muslim world, whether you're in Egypt, whether you're in Pakistan, whether you're in Jordan. And then you can see how Islam itself, any talk of compassion or sense or mercy, then becomes distorted and even perverted in acts of violence.
But more of that wealth is in places like Dubai and in Saudi Arabia.
Exactly. That's the problem. Muslims are very conscious of this. I've talked to, on this journey, taxi drivers and ordinary students, and the first criticism is of their own rulers. They'll say, these people are living lives of wastefulness. What have they invested in education, in our lives? All their money's abroad. They live lives of debauchery. This is not Islam at all. And again, paradoxically, that feeds into the third model of Islam. We need pure Islam. We need to get back to Puritan Islam.
But hasn't Saudi Arabia been the exporter of pure Islam?
I think
the Wahhabis?
I think in a sense they want to checkmate this before it happens, because the criticism of the ruling family has been loud and clear in many parts of the Muslim world, and for many years, long before 9/11. So you have a very complicated and a volatile situation developing.
What came out of your meeting with President Musharraf? Did he say anything that was surprising, because he didn't after he wrote his memoir?
Well, surprising was his reference to Napoleon Bonaparte when I asked him about his great role models and people who inspired him. He had great admiration for Bonaparte, and I understood why, because he was obviously equating himself to a military commander who was then in a position to implement social and civil reform. And Musharraf, of course, has not been able to pull that off. He's certainly not a military commander in terms of Bonaparte either, and what we've seen of the military campaigns he's fought in. But that did surprise me, because he didn't talk about the traditional Muslim heroes.
But Pakistan is a special situation. The military pretty much runs the country's businesses as well as its government and its military arm.
It is, and it's causing a great deal of unhappiness. If you read some of the commentary in Pakistan today, and I would urge you to do this, Leonard, because Pakistan is a key ally of the United States. It is a major non-NATO ally, the status given by the United States. It is key for the war on terror on the eastern frontier, and yet it is wobbling on anarchy. Because if you lose Pakistan, remember Pakistan is nuclear, population of 165 million people, and at a critical point on the world map. And yet, as you say, there is a great antipathy and anger against the army, and the army there in Pakistan is seen very much allied to the West. So Musharraf is called Busharraf by a lot of Pakistanis in contempt. And you will have that reaction and the backlash if something were to happen overnight to Musharraf.
You say that Pakistan's leaders are selective in their embrace of globalization.
Yes, because what I would like them to be doing in their own countries is to be implementing genuine democracy. Let anyone come in who is good and elected by the people, and when the people are fed up, let them throw them out. This was the great success of India. Let them bring in human rights, civil liberties, the things that globalization talks about, but not to be selective, which means, all right, we will be part of this international financial order or the multi-corporation, and we, the elite, will make the money, and the gap between us and the poor becomes wider and wider and wider.
Although India hasn't been able to sustain a truly non-religious government either. So
it hasn't, but remember the lessons from India are democracy. It's far from perfect, but it's chugging along. Now, compared to Pakistan, and remember, both began life in 1947 with more or less equal chances. In fact,
August 14th and August 15th, depending on which country you're talking about.
Yes, exactly. And yet you have 60 years on, you see India almost reaching a different category in terms of economic and political and international influences, and Pakistan still struggling simply to have a basic democracy.
We have very little time, but I wonder, is the outlook entirely bleak? Did you come across any examples of religious and cultural tolerance?
Many examples, and that's what gives me a great deal of hope. And I would say we are at the crossroads right now, and I hope all those people thinking, talking, implementing dialogue will prevail so that they can push the direction of the world into the 21st century towards dialogue, understanding, friendship, and tolerance and acceptance of each other.
And you saw real, I mean, people who were not saying that they were pleased that Osama bin Laden has not been captured?
Well, a lot of people throughout this journey, as you know, the statistics were something like 15-20% would constantly say Osama bin Laden is our role model. But a lot of other Muslims were absolutely horrified that this man could represent Islam at all. So there is that debate within Islam. And again, if you look at it in terms of the three models, anyone from the first, the mystic or the modernist model would not want Osama bin Laden to either represent him or her or even speak on behalf of Islam.
We didn't have time to talk about Ijaz Arshad Kazmi, who was your guide in Pakistan, is also translating one of your books, Islam Under Siege, into Urdu. I suspect it'll give you an interesting insight to see your own book in your native language.
Yes, because he was a key figure in the opposite third category, if you like, and now he's shifting to the second, so I'm very pleased with that.
Thank you so much, Akbar Ahmed, Islamic scholar and professor at American University in Washington, D.C. His book, Journey into Islam, published by Brookings Institution Press. On tomorrow's show, Underreported, will feature Mia Farrow, who explains why she offered to exchange her own freedom for that of an imprisoned Darfur rebel. Plus, Ethan Hawke describes writing, directing, and appearing in a film adaptation of his own novel, The Hot Estate. Then the great jazz drummer Chico Hamilton reminisces about playing with everyone from Duke Ellington to Count Basie to Charles Lloyd. And Tom Ricks gives us an update on what he's called the fiasco in Iraq and predicts what General Petraeus will say to Congress in September. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English and Blake Neeshick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Stephen Valentino, Rory Bernstein, Tanya Wiedeking, and Scott Goldberg. Jay Cowett was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.